Before we begin, if you want to join our growing group of supporters and give $5, $10 or $20 a month to help make the show even better, you can sign up to the Harder Reports Patreon right now and get exclusive access to full, unedited interviews with guests. That's the Harder Reports Patreon at patreon.com/TheHarderReport. And now, today's episode. Hello and welcome to the Harder Report. My name's Edward Hardy, and for today's interview, I'm joined by Lawrence Lessig, an academic, attorney, activist. He was the former director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. He ran for president in 2016, and most recently is the author of the book, They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy, which is available to purchase now. Lawrence Lessig, thank you for joining me.
Glad to be here.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you've recently written a book titled They Don't Represent Us, with one review stating that, quote, the book is brimming with promising and provocative proposals to fix campaign finance, gerrymandering, the electoral college, the filibuster, and the mind-numbing effects of cable news and social media, describing it as a repair manual for government. How do you even begin to fix a government and political system that, as you concede, has so many flaws?
I think the first step is to give people a conception of exactly what's wrong with the system. I think everybody feels like something's not working. And some people look at the money in politics problem and think that's the reason it's not working. And other people looking at the gerrymandering problem think that's why it's not working, or the electoral college or vote suppression. Everybody has their pet theory. But what I tried to do in this book is to knit them together and to show that, in fact, all of these problems are the same problem. They all follow from a representative democracy that doesn't allow citizens to be represented equally. And if we could just embrace that core principle built into the idea of a representative democracy and begin to build reform around that idea, then I think we could begin to see change that could actually make a difference to the democracy.
You know that the current system of government cannot be fixed and reformed with one election or one political figure. Is that part of the reason why these actions that you've proposed, which many might agree with out there, haven't occurred yet? Because instead of focusing on reforms that might, in the long run, provide a huge benefit to the US political system, politicians instead want to engage with these smaller, short-term policies that have an immediate noticeable effect so they can receive credit for those when they run for re-election.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an ordinary business model to being a politician. In the presidency of the United States, it's very clear what that business model is. You know, I was a believer in Barack Obama. I think Barack Obama, when he first started running for president, genuinely wanted to fix the system. But I'm certain that, you know, the very first day he sat down as president with his chief of staff, if he had said to his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, look, I'm going to take on the corrupting influence of money in politics and I'm going to fix the system, Rahm Emanuel would have said to him, look, you do that, you're a one-term president. Because to take on the system, you got to take on your own party. You take on your own party, that means you'll get not a single significant piece of legislation passed. And so at the end of 4 years, people will look back and say, you're a total failure. It's time to get rid of President Obama. And that argument is true. It's sensible. It's actually the right understanding that any new president should bring to this question, which means that we can't rely on normal politicians or the normal political process to fix this kind of problem. We have to build a movement or an understanding that's above it or beyond it if we're ever going to have a chance to do anything with it.
One area where you're calling for reform is the Electoral College. The Electoral College is something that a lot of people probably just accepted as a fact of the American electoral system. But in 2016, the second time a Republican president won the presidency, despite losing the popular vote, we saw Donald Trump and George W. Bush both get elected president due to the Electoral College system. What system do you think should be in place, or how do you change the Electoral College to make it a fairer, more representative system across America?
Well, look, if we started from scratch today, and thought about the questions the way the framers of our Constitution thought about them, we obviously would pick a national popular vote. We'd have a single system for counting the vote and for running the administration of the vote. We'd cover the whole nation, and every vote would be equal. But equally obviously, we're not going to be able to move to that system in America anytime soon, because the Electoral College is built not on the assumption of a single national vote. It's built on the assumption that elections happen state by state, if they happen at all. The Electoral College allows a state to just pick its electors directly. It don't even have to have an election. But it happens state by state. Every state has its own election. And the question we need to think about now is how to modify that system to get close to the ideals of equal representation. And I think there's a pretty obvious way in which it could be not modified. But the way to see it is to see the core problem. The core problem with the Electoral College is nothing in the Constitution. It's the fact that states have decided to give all of their electors to the winner of the popular vote in their state. So if you get 50% plus one of the votes in California, you get every single elector in California, regardless of the division in the state. The state gets represented as a single color, red or blue. And what that means is the only states that matter in a presidential race are the states that could go one way or another, the so-called swing states. So in 2014, in 2016, there were 14 states that were swing states. They saw 99% of campaign spending, 99% in those 14 states. In 2020, it's probably 9 states, maybe 8 states that will be swing states. And they too will see 99% of campaign spending, because it doesn't make sense to spend any time outside of the swing states. But what that means is the president of the United States cares deeply about what those people in those swing states want, but doesn't care at all about what anybody else wants, because nobody else really matters to his election or her election as president. And that reality follows simply from the fact that states allocate their electors in a winner-take-all fashion. If states allocated their electors proportionally, or I think proportionally at a fractional level, so you could get 1.35 votes out of Montana if you're a Democrat and you got 45%, then you would see every state mattering to the president, and you would see a president who's much more representative of America as a whole. And that system would actually benefit 40 states over the current system, because the current system only benefits the swing states. But the other 40 states, or the other 42 states, would actually be better off if we had this alternative. So I think there's a way to get to this kind of reform, this kind of change, and we certainly will be pushing for that in the next 4 years.
So it's about convincing the electorate out there that actually this is in their interest, instead of politicians focusing on those swing states that you've mentioned. And we're all familiar with how elections often focus on states like Florida or Michigan or Wisconsin, Pennsylvania.
Those people in the flyover states, as they're called, would find themselves having a greater voice. And that's why you believe this would be a positive change that should be made.
Yeah, I mean, the principle is every state should matter. You know, you shouldn't be less important to the president because you happen to be a Democrat living in Texas or a Republican living in Utah. I mean, you know, Republicans in Utah are overwhelming majority of the voters in Utah, but they don't matter to the president because the president knows if he's a Republican, he's going to win Utah. So this would make it so everybody in the nation mattered. And that's what's essential if we're going to bring about a change to the current system, to make it so that we have enough support to bring about a constitutional amendment to effect that change.
You've advocated for a second constitutional convention. Do you see that as the way to get this electoral college system changed? Or do you think there's an easier way by putting this question on the ballot paper in one election and let all the states decide? What approach would you take to get such a significant change made to the way America conducts elections?
Well, look, I'm a law professor, so I'm going to quibble with the word you used. I don't want a constitutional convention. I want a convention to propose amendments to the Constitution. And the distinction's important because a constitutional convention, in principle, has the power to change the Constitution completely, and you know, even change the rules for amending the Constitution. And I don't think we need anything like that. We should get nowhere close to something like that. But a convention for proposing amendments to the Constitution is really important and critical, because it's the only way we can propose amendments that change the existing institutions in a way that the institutions don't like. So Congress is a core part of the problem of our existing republic. It's just a failed institution. We can't count on that failed institution to fix itself. It's just not going to do it. And so what I think we need to do is to recognize that if we're going to bring about changes to these institutions, changes that could really matter to these institutions, we're going to have to use a device that doesn't depend on them. And that's what an Article 5 or a proposing convention would be. And that's what I support.
During the last presidential election cycle, you ran for president on a platform of campaign finance reform and electoral reform. Why do you feel those issues have been pushed to the side since then?
Well, you know, I actually think there was enormous progress over the last 4 years. When I tried to become a candidate in 2016, and I said we ought to focus on a fundamental package of reform that included campaign finance reform, gerrymandering reform, voting reform, people thought it was kind of crazy. You know, they were like, you know, nobody's going to care about thinking about fundamental issues like that. 4 years later, you know, we have a Congress that the House of Representatives passed, which is called H.R. 1, which was exactly that package of reform. Nancy Pelosi committed to doing it, and she passed a package of reform that included public funding of congressional campaigns, the end of gerrymandering and voting rights reform, as well as additional ethics reform. And then our group, Equal Citizens, along with Represent Us and Citizens United, ran a concerted campaign to get every single candidate running for president to commit to fundamental reform. And so we got every Democrat except one to commit that within the first 100 days of his or her administration, they would enact fundamental reform that would include each of those elements. Now, of course, the problem is the one who didn't make that commitment was Joe Biden. So we have a Democratic nominee who's not yet committed to fundamental reform. And that's, of course, a terrible loss given the extraordinary success the movement had made over the last 4 years. But I still think we should look at the success and recognize that that signals the hope that we have that something important could be done if we just get the right candidates to do it.
Do you believe that given the support and the movement, particularly on the Democratic side for these reforms, that if Joe Biden is successful in this election, even though he did not make the same pledge as other candidates, that he would in fact go ahead and pass these reforms regardless because his party and those that will come out and vote for him believe in it?
I don't know. I mean, what I've come to find is that people either are invested and committed to this idea or they're not. And the critical thing is to get candidates for whom this is a real important commitment that they make central to their campaign. You know, if you look at Hillary Clinton in 2016, her campaign was actually much better at articulating these issues and providing solutions than any other Democratic campaign. Indeed, you know, she was better than Bernie Sanders on these issues, but she never really believed in them. She never really talked about them. She never made them central to what she was fighting for. And so even though she wasn't on paper the best person about these issues, she was not somebody who actually delivered a commitment to them in a way that would make it plausible for other candidates to follow. So I don't know where Joe Biden is. I hope that Joe Biden realizes why it's so important that these reforms be taken up and taken up first. And if he does realize that and he gets elected and we have a Democratic Senate, then I hope that he pushes to make these reforms happen. because I'm pretty convinced that if he doesn't, then there's no real chance to get anything else significant done, and we'll have another 4 years of stalemate and not real progress on the important issues that there are.
On your website, Lessig.org, you've a section titled The Non-Corruption Principle, where you state that you, quote, believe that behavior inconsistent with these principles, at least among professionals, is a kind of corruption. Does this link into your belief in campaign finance reform? Do you see this as one of the driving forces behind that call? As members of Congress who rely on money from wealthy donors or corporations to get re-elected are then beholden to these individuals that, in a way, they are corrupted by the money they've taken.
Yeah, it's the same issue. You know, if you, as an academic, or you, as a politician, are dependent on a very small number of funders to support your work, those funders have enormous influence over you. And if you haven't built into the institution structures to assure your independence, they can leverage that dependence to control you. So, you know, when academics are funded by industry who have an interest in the ultimate results of that research, that certainly will bend the research to benefit the industry, whether consciously or not. It's just unavoidable that it will have that effect. And the same thing with politicians. When politicians spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money from a tiny, tiny fraction of the 1%, it just can't help but be the case that they will bend in the direction of that tiny fraction of the 1% in order to make sure that that tiny fraction continues to be happy about the particular support that they've been giving those candidates. So I think it's the same idea. It's just in two different contexts.
A key element of that non-corruption principle is also transparency, ensuring you clearly disclose any payments that might be seen as impacting views or policies that are advocated for. But the current occupant of the White House, Donald Trump, has sought to do everything in his power to hide his tax returns, keep his finances under wraps. Do you believe it should be a legal requirement for all presidential candidates to fully disclose their financial situation so voters know if there's anything that could influence that individual to take a policy position when they're in office?
Yeah, of course. I think it's critical that they be fully transparent about their own personal interests. And obviously this president is incredibly corrupt in the relationships that he's developed with his power as president and his personal wealth and personal financial incentives. I mean, you know, the most grotesque example, it's the smallest in some sense, but it just shows the level of corruption that has risen up in this administration is, you know, the FBI building, if you've been to Washington, is right downtown on Capitol Hill. It's on a beautiful stretch of land near the mall. And the FBI has requested to move its headquarters to Virginia because it's very expensive to have employees have to go down to the center of DC to do their work. They could have a much bigger space in Virginia. It would be cheaper to run, cheaper for employees to work there. It would be better for everybody. But across the street from the FBI building is Donald Trump's hotel. And so when the FBI was considering its move, the White House reached out to veto the move. Why? Because it would impact Donald Trump's revenue at his hotel. And that level of self-dealing is just really unprecedented in the history of American politics. You know, even in the Harding administration, which had a lot of corruption by high-level officials, nobody really thought Warren Harding himself was trying to benefit himself through this corruption. But this is direct, pure corruption to benefit the president financially. And, you know, when I began doing my work about corruption, I was trying to help people understand that there was a kind of corruption that wasn't this self-interested corruption in the way that Donald Trump is evincing it. You know, it's a more indirect, structural, and institutional corruption. But you know, Trump has kind of made all of that seem quaint because he is as openly corrupt as you can imagine a president to be.
That work that you did on tackling campaign finance reform was done at the time through the crowdfunded political action committee, the May Day PAC, which sought to elect candidates to Congress who would pass campaign finance reform. How do you feel that work went, looking back on that now? And do you feel that that work there has built this groundwork for where we're at now with people seeing campaign finance reform as a crucial political issue that needs to be addressed? You've got a lot of progressive Democrats making that a main policy platform in their political campaigns.
Well, I wouldn't claim that that PAC is responsible for the current groundswell of support. And I would, you know, I actually think that we made an important strategic mistake in that PAC that I regret we made. So when I originally proposed the idea of that PAC, the idea was to run in 2016 a campaign to elect a Congress that would pass fundamental reform. And the idea was to elect 50 members to Congress from both the Republican and Democratic Party who would form a kind of caucus that would control Congress because it would be the block large enough to deny either side control of Congress. And it would basically say, we're not going to do anything else until we pass fundamental reform. And my original idea was we could fund that PAC by getting 50 billionaires to commit up to $20 million each to make it possible to elect those 50 members, those 50 reformers from Congress. What I was convinced to do by, you know, the so-called experts in politics was to, instead of running that in 2016 as a big idea, to run a kind of test run of it in 2014 for a small pilot project to sort of elect 8 to 10 members of Congress under the same idea. So that was a mistake, I think, because you know, whereas I think that if we had done it in 2016, focused on the big idea of a $1 billion super PAC to make Congress no longer corrupted, it would have captured the imagination of many, many people and helped them see what changes could actually happen and bring them into the project because it was plausible that there would be a real change. But when we ran it as a pilot project of just 8 to 10, I think most people could look at it and say, well, you know, I fully support the idea of reforming corruption in Congress, but you know, electing 8 to 10 members of Congress is not going to do that. It's not going to change anything. So why should I be excited about that project or try to do anything to support that project? So I think we were self-defeating by limiting our aspiration. And I wish that now that we had instead held back for 2 more years and in 2016 and done what we had tried to do, because I think that if we'd done it in 2016, it would have helped rally Clinton's campaign, if she were the nominee, to be much more supportive of reform and I think resist the ultimate power that Trump had in somehow making it sound like she was the corrupt one and he was the virtuous one.
One area where you haven't called for changes, but others have, is the Supreme Court. You clerked for Justice Antonin Scalia when he was on the US Supreme Court. What do you make of the argument proposed by some that to counter how the Republican Party has turned the Supreme Court conservative has been very partisan in its approach to the Supreme Court? The next Democratic president should just pack the court with liberal justices.
Well, I mean, I don't have any opposition to the idea of appointing liberal justices to the United States Supreme Court. I hope that happens in the next administration because I think that that's what needs to happen. But I do oppose the idea of packing the court. You know, what that traditionally means is, you know, expanding the number of seats on the court solely for the purpose of adding new justices according to your politics to balance out the the justices on the other side. And the reason I resist that is not because I think that the current balance is just or appropriate. I don't. I think that what Mitch McConnell did in blocking Merrick Garland's nomination was outrageous. And I think that, the Republicans should pay dearly for that offense. And we should find every political response to that possible, including removing Mitch McConnell from the United States Senate. I'm all for that. But I don't want to further politicize the United States Supreme Court. I think that would be a terrible thing. And so I am more interested in finding a strategy for responding to the political threats politically than to make the Supreme Court even more political than it already is.
Do you think there should be some sort of rule in place that ensures the Supreme Court is permanently balanced between political persuasions so that, as it was set up, it's not a partisan body, but it's able to pass fair judgments on cases?
I would not make that change the priority. I think it's just a mistake to try to frame the Supreme Court in political terms like that. So, you know, most of the cases the court decides are not political cases like that. And I think putting that lens on undermines the integrity of the institution. I think we should say to the justices on the institution, whatever your politics were, that's in the past. You should now think of yourself as justices and do your job according to what your conception of justice is. And so I would think more about changes that would reinforce that idea. And so some of those changes could be things like the German system for its constitutional court, which is to allow, you know, to make it so that we have limited terms and justices leave the Supreme Court. You know, we could do that right now by just moving them from the Supreme Court to other courts. We could say, you get elevated to the Supreme Court, you can serve there for 15 years, and then you move off. You move to another lower court, or you retire. It's up to you. We could do that right now without any constitutional change. And if we did that so that every administration would know that it would get one or two appointments to the Supreme Court, we could radically lower the political cost of any particular appointment. I mean, you know, right now, the next appointee is going to radically cement the direction of the court one way or the other. So, I mean, if the next appointee is a Republican appointee, that's it. The Supreme Court is locked in as a conservative court for the next 30 years. And if it's a Democratic appointee, then, you know, there's a fighting chance. We'll see what happens to Justice Thomas and the balance there. I think that vulnerability or that importance to any particular nominee is a function of the relatively small size of the court and the fact that appointments are so rare. But we could fix both. We could say we're going to grow the court, not in a packing way. We won't say we'll add five Democratic justices, but, you know, we might increase the court to 13 over a number of years, maybe a number of administrations. And we say the justices serve for just 15 years and then they move on. And that dynamic, I think, would reduce the political character of the court substantially.
You've discussed a number of reforms you'd seek to make to the US system of government. However, these are big sweeping changes. Do you think that cable news and social media, this desire for people to get instant information and results, makes it harder to get politicians on board with these larger projects?
Yes. I actually increasingly think that the architecture of media right now is the single most important blockage to the functioning of democracy. And it's not the architecture in a technical sense. It's not the fact that there's an internet or cable TV, but it's more the business model of those platforms of media that has created the huge blockage for democracy. Because what's so striking about the business model is that they profit, both cable TV and the internet profits, the more they leverage the politics of hate, and the more they advance the misunderstanding between different parts of our political environment. And so, you know, the most striking thing about you know, the Trump administration, is to see the way in which attitudes towards Donald Trump have been absolutely impervious to whatever happens. You know, whether it's the impeachment or the debacle of this pandemic, doesn't matter. Republicans never change their view about Donald Trump. And the reason for that is Roger Ailes. The reason for that is Roger Ailes and his innovation with Fox News to create a news channel that would reinforce the president's base. And what's so striking about this history is, you know, Roger Ailes worked for Richard Nixon. He was the media man, the television man for Richard Nixon. And there's a famous exchange where Richard Nixon, you know, says, you know, those Chinese and those Soviets, they have their own media. They have their own media channel. I need a Pravda. Roger, how can I get a Pravda? Well, that's what Roger Ailes did. He gave a conservative president's Pravda. And Pravda, through Fox News, constantly bends the truth to reinforce the attitudes of the base. And what that means is the base never has a reason to question whatever the president does. Well, we can't live in a democracy where people live in these different epistemic universes. It can't function. The presupposition of democracy is that we all understand the same story and then express our views about it. I have a liberal view, you might have a conservative view, that's fine. But at least we have to understand the same facts. And we don't right now, not because there's an internet, but because of the business model that sits on top of the internet that is driven by advertising and the dependencies that creates.
When you've got those media organizations and also social media sites which profit from sensationalized news, not necessarily factual news, how do you truly deal with that situation? Because in the US, you obviously have the First Amendment right, so can't currently legislate against those individuals. So how do you address that so we bring us back to a place where the news is there to inform and educate, not to mislead people?
I don't know. You know, I mean, we have a lot of experiments to conduct, and not all of them can happen in America. So, for example, I think we should have a very comprehensive experiment about shutting down advertising on social media during political campaigns. You know, it's unclear whether Donald Trump was elected by Facebook, but I think it's pretty clear that Brexit happened because of social media. I think that the evidence about the distortion that was affected through that campaign, especially in the last week, is pretty compelling, that led people to misunderstand what was at issue in a way that led to Brexit being adopted. And I think that if we could just turn off the tools of strategic manipulation, at least by non-candidates, during that last period up in a campaign, and see what happens to social media, see whether it's poisonous in the same way, that would be enormous progress. And I think that's the first thing we should try. But we can't do that in the United States, because in the United States, the First Amendment would prohibit that kind of regulation. And so I think we have to find other countries to run that kind of experiment and see what we can learn from it.
Finally, what would be your closing message to convince politicians and the public at large to join your call for these changes? And that these reforms that you've proposed aren't just necessary to fix the political system in America, but are actually in their benefit, and they create a fairer, more just, more democratic country for them to live in.
Well, you know, we have a saying in the United States, the canary in the coal mine. And that idea is, like, miners used to take canaries down into the coal mine. And when the canaries died, that meant that there was gas in the air, and the miners got out as quickly as they could. America is democracy's canary in the coal mine, because all of the structural features that have destroyed our democracy are more advanced in America than they are anywhere else. I mean, every country is moving towards media much like America, but they're slower. They're less advanced in that transition. And I don't mean advanced in a good way. I mean advanced in a bad way. And so I think that everybody who cares about democracy should look at what's going wrong in America and begin to think, are we replicating the same problem here? So Britain is a perfect example. You know, I think that this mindless Thatcherism about media that weakens the BBC and weakens institutions of integrity in the media, is just making Britain more and more like America. And obviously, you know, I love my country and I'm deeply committed to my country, but I'm love my country and deeply committed to it enough to say, we have really screwed this up. We have really built exactly the wrong set of institutions to support self-government. And other countries should not be following us. Other countries should be learning the mistakes we make and make different policy choices. And that's the critical fact that I think people need to take from America. Not that America is the most important. It's just America is an important lesson for other democracies that don't want to go down the path that we've gone down.
Lawrence Lessig, thank you for joining me.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
That was Lawrence Lessig, an academic, attorney, and activist. His book, They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy, is available to purchase now. You can find out more about him on Twitter at Lessig and at lessig.org. That's all for today's episode. What did you think about that interview? Let me know on Twitter at Edward T. Hardy. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating and subscribe, or recommend this podcast by submitting a review online and sharing it with friends and family. Until next time, goodbye.